We need to talk about a new Mel Brooks movie. I got it.
I got it.
We're talking about High Anxiety. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to your new favorite show, The More You Nerd, where this month it's all about Mel, and we are watching one that one of us has only seen one time prior to this, and one that the other has never seen before, High Anxiety. My name is Drew, and I need my co-host, who ever so often thinks he's a dog. Miles, how are you, my friend?
I don't know. I'm doing good. I was very, very excited to take on this one. One, yes, because I had not seen it, and it's always exciting to get to something that I have not experienced before, especially with someone like Mel Brooks. This was one of my few holes in his filmography, so I was really excited to like get to pinpoint that stuff during our Mel Brooks centennial celebration. Oh, that would have been a good name for the month.
The Mel Brooks centennial. It would have been a little too long, I think, but
we've done longer.
Sure.
It's interesting because, you know, and this isn't really a spoiler for the episode, but just looking at the response from the film, how well it did. It's interesting to like kind of look at this as like, it's not really like some sort of deep cut, or it's not really like some vastly underrated film. I actually think the like looking at some of the fair criticism, it's a very properly rated film, but it's somehow just one that isn't talked about when you talk about Mel Brooks, mostly because when you think about Mel Brooks, a lot of times, yes, they'll play Young Frankenstein every Halloween. Robin Hood Men in Tights is on permanent repeat. During July, people would play Spaceballs. It's a career that has like some very, very looming films that other films who are not failures, and they did pretty well on their own merit, they're still kind of in that shadow of those bigger movies, you know?
It's true, because this is a movie that I think people know about. But of the films that Mel Brooks has made, it is one of the ones that people don't really talk about. So,
which is so interesting because, I mean, for the time, again, this movie is 49 years old. And or it's turning 49 this year because it was a Christmas release. This movie cost $4 million and made $31 million in 1977, which is a huge chunk of change.
That ain't bad, dog. Yeah. So again, we talked about the 12 Chairs last week. We've skipped Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, because, I mean, frankly, neither movie needs any introduction. You don't need us to tell you that those movies are classics.
Yeah, those movies both came out in 1974. So 12 Chairs was 70. Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein were 74. Silent Movie, which I think is another one of his films that is, I think, more artistically appreciated, but not one that you hear a lot of stuff
and
about.
You and I kind of went back and forth on doing both of them, but we wanted to have at least one late stage film as well.
Yeah. So Silent Movie was 76 and High Anxiety is 77. This has been a pretty busy time for old Mel.
This is like the prime of his directing career.
Yeah. And where, you know, Blazing Saddles spoofed Westerns, Young Frankenstein spoofed specifically Frankenstein, but with some other horror stuff kind of mixed in. Mm-hmm. Silent Movie spoof silent movies in a way that is absolutely fantastic. And I think the reason that it's not talked about more is because there aren't any really good lines in that movie because it's a silent film.
Right. And I love the little note that this is Brooks's first film as a producer and first speaking lead role, because his first lead role was silent movie in which he did not speak.
Yeah. And of course the one spoken line in silent movie was done by famous mime Marcel Marceau, which is just a fantastic little
which
bit
is like a great just meta joke. I love that, and that is one thing that I think is where Brooks shines, because the thing about Mel Brooks is he makes these great crowd-pleasing comedies that are intelligent, and people kind of expect some intelligence, but these movies are often crafted with much more like intention than you'd think, and especially a Mel Brooks comedy, and seeing the layers and seeing like, oh, what he's doing in this scene, like, yes, here's the obvious funny thing, but here's like 10 other things that you might have missed about why this scene is hilarious, or And jokes that I'll miss because, oh, I didn't realize that. Or, hey, in 1970s culture, people were much more, you know, aware of this thing, you know. And so I did read a middling review that I actually thought was pretty interesting, if not a little full of itself, that... doing a spoof, Drew started to say that this spoofs Alfred Hitchcock films predominantly, with couple of things
going after largely one director's oeuvre, which is very, very bold.
Well, one of the reviewers said doing a Hitchcock one is tough because Hitchcock himself was funny and injected humor into his movies, so it makes it a kind of a tougher sell to be like, oh, I'm gonna make a parody of these. I'm like, but these things are already funny. It's kind of like Scary Movie doing Scream. Scream itself was a parody of 80s slashers, but because most people our age, because they were all 12, had not seen a lot of them except for me, like they went in because the tone was so like about faced and stark, took Scream as a serious slasher. I know several people who think the movie's genuinely scary and like a slasher, but it's a spoof. And then you have like something like Scary Movie that like, okay, here we're gonna beat you over the head with the most obvious like SNL reject comedy that's ever been put to film.
I've never seen Scary Movie. I should not say that out loud in a public forum, but that's okay.
Yeah, you're fine.
But yeah,
don't say it in front of my fiance. She adores those movies. I do not.
So where again, we have the general concept of Westerns or spoofing kind of a single movie in Frankenstein. This is attempting, I think it's largely focused on specifically Vertigo. But there are a number of references to other Hitchcock films in this. High Anxiety, which has a fantastic poster that just looks like
Mel. Oh, it's wonderful. I love this poster.
It's so good. And the sort of visual effects when he has his High Anxiety, one of the best jokes in this movie is that High Anxiety is just a fear of heights. That's all it is. It's just very funny that they have this whole funny name for it. And it's just that it's a great joke, I think.
It's a very, very good joke. There are several excellent, like, I think one of the reviews that I had seen was like, when this movie hits, it just absolutely sings. But like there is, it somehow feels lesser Brooks to some folks. And I have to say, I think this movie's pretty bang on smart.
That's...
I'm I'm a big fan of this one.
That's interesting because I like it. I think it's fun and I think it has very high highs. But watching it the second time, I just kind of kept checking out, which is weird.
I absolutely, here's the thing. I totally see that. Like, because I fully agree. This is an uneven movie. But I think when it sings better than when it's just kind of there. Because there are some kind of very surface level, not great, very juvenile sex jokes that kind of recur. And that happens a lot in Brooks films, but like usually they're funny or like at least a good turn of phrase, like a roll in the hay, you know?
Bondage
is a thing. We're gonna make the same bondage joke 12 times.
Yeah. Although I did really like it when he sat down after that scene and yelped. That was very, very funny.
Also, you are always going to win me over with the inclusion of Cloris Leachman. I adore Cloris Leachman. One of my all-time faves.
So I agree, Miles. I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying. And I raise you, Madeline Kahn.
Oh, 1,000% agree. Madeline Kahn, I texted you this today.
I know you did.
Madeline Kahn in the airport steals the entire movie to me.
So let's talk about briefly, the quote unquote plot of this movie. Mel plays the main character, Dr. Richard Thorndike, who is going to become he's flying into L.A. And we already see his high anxiety as he gets off the plane because he doesn't like flying. And he's going to become the head of the Psychoneurotic Institute for the Very, Very Nervous. And the second very is underlined.
It's great.
Which is great, especially because when you see some of the people that are there wearing their sort of required pajamas that just has the acronym, the second V on the acronym is also underlined, which is just, I love that. I think that's great. And he is so he's there to replace somebody who passed away mysteriously, then sort of as he gets there, the game is afoot as he meets all these people like Dr. Wentworth, Dr. Montague, and Nurse Diesel, who has some very interesting costume choices, as they sort of kind of go through what may have happened to this other guy, as well as, you know, all sorts of stuff that sort of involves then going to San Francisco to go to a convention where he maybe kill somebody, but definitely didn't kill somebody. And then all sort of culminating in this sort of fight between them as some of the powers that be are not happy with this selection because they think they should be in charge because they could get all the money from one of the people that was being kept there against their will.
I think one of the things to also keep in mind is Mel Brooks was purposefully like studying how Hitchcock filmed these movies and spent time with Hitchcock himself to kind of nail the style because he wanted the movie to feel like a Hitchcock film, at least to a degree, until like, say, the camera runs into a piece of glass.
This... Miles, I hate that I laugh at that stuff so much because it's such
every single time it happens.
It's such a cheap joke and it's so good.
So good. It's so good, dude.
And he uses it in so many things. I'm not even sure if it's the first time he uses it here, but.
But the way he uses it is so funny, especially in the pan out scene at the end. It is. Very, very good. And I also have to give a lot of credit to Mel Brooks himself. I think he's a really great comedic leading man. Like the guy, he definitely feels like he is the ringmaster. There is a feeling about this guy, even watching him, was like, okay, this is the guy who's conducting this entire orchestra of chaos.
Yeah. And as we talked about last week in the 12 Chairs, he only took a role in the 12 Chairs because the actor that he wanted to get for that role couldn't do it. And so that was the first time he had ever performed in one of his own things. And then in the next movie, he has sort of a different little role. And in the next movie, he doesn't really have much of a role at all because they kind of filmed back to back and he was probably pretty busy doing both. And then now in his third film, he's starring. And his fourth film, he's both starring and talking. And it's kind of a big deal. You know what I mean? We're now in a different era of Mel Brooks that we weren't in just a couple of years before. But a thing that will kind of go through, at least, you know, I take it back. I was going to say, because he kind of stars in everything after that, but he really doesn't. It's Silent Movie and High Anxiety and History of the World Part 1, which are the ones that he really, really stars in, but he doesn't really star in a lot of his own stuff.
No, he'll pop up and he'll play like Yogurt and
He was President Scroob in Spaceballs, which is a pretty big deal, but not the main character,
right?
He
was the star of Life Stinks, though, right?
He was the star of Life Stinks. I forget about Life Stinks, because I actually haven't seen Life Stinks, but that is also one that is,
I haven't either. That's another one that I hadn't seen, but I know that one's a huge bomb.
It was a huge bomb, and it's one he's very proud of. But you know,
which is kind of why I want to see it, because I love someone like something fails, and they're like, "I don't care. That's my best one."
Yeah,
I don't care what you say. I love that about him, and I love that kind of moxie. So like, it makes me want to see that movie more. The fact that he's like, "Nah, y'all are wrong." So, I respect that deeply.
So early movie, what scenes stood out to you? What sort of bits, what gags, what sort of things stood out at the early part?
I'm trying
part
to
of
think. There was a lot of, I mean, I don't know, there's a lot of good like one-liner things that I enjoy. I loved everything with his mentor.
The mentor is very funny. What was his? Dr. Victor, little old man.
Little old man. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That whole bit was great.
He's a little old man.
Obviously, the opening bits with Cloris Leachman just basically playing like Nurse Ratchet, you know?
Yeah. Like the fact that in a lot of her scenes, she is just wearing a jet black nurse's uniform with sequins on the hat is very, very funny to me.
Yeah, and I mean, look, Cloris Leachman has a deep well, but I think one of her like go-tos is like, oh, I'm just gonna play the very strict, screwed up person and is going to deliver every time. She is basically the grandmother from Malcolm Middle here. If for those of you who are not familiar with her earlier work, but or a millennial, she plays the grandma in Malcolm in the Middle, and she is phenomenal. She is basically Nurse Diesel. It's great.
There's something else her performance reminded me of. And I'm sure the nurse uniform led me to this conclusion. I would not be surprised if her role in this film was not heavily influential on the Joker from The Dark Knight. The line delivery that she has.
Yeah. No, I think you're right.
The way that she holds certain, and I didn't write down the line that she said that reminded me of Heath Ledger's Joker so much, but it just, the way that she holds like certain syllables and things like that, just it reminded me so much of that Joker.
No, I think that is a phenomenal point. I'm all in. I fully agree with you. I see that, like, there are certain things about this that feel like, you know, are both informed by the prior movies, but also things that like carry into his other films. And I mean, obviously, Cloris Leachman was in Young Frankenstein, and, you know, not playing the same character, but certainly playing kind of this jilted, bitter, authoritarian woman.
Yeah. Dun, dun, dun. That's what's...
And I love her to pieces. She's very, very funny. I think the third act, they just kind of forget about her. And then the way they write her off, while the gag is kind of good, it just kind of, the whole thing just doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, what about you? Did you have some early moments that really stuck out to you?
So the early parts of this movie, this is a very, very visual movie in a way that...
makes it difficult to talk about.
Kind of. So, but like the airport that they land in, which I didn't look up to see whether it was actually what LAX looked like at the time, but it's very, very 1970s. And you have this like, like there's so much color and there's so many like, it's almost dizzying to look at it. And I wonder, you know, what it would have looked like to watch it in a big theater with all of these lines and patterns and this and that. Like it would probably be a little, I don't want to say unnerving, but it would just kind of, you know, kind of shake you up a little bit to see something like that, even in just a scene where he's walking through the airport. And I think that works really, really well for the idea of this person being afraid of heights and afraid to fly. And of course you go straight from that to the flasher in the bathroom who is pretending to be a cop. Like, I need you to come with me to the toilet. What? And then it just happens. And it's just, it's just a very, very,
it's a great sequence. I enjoy that quite a bit. There is some stuff that gets a little overplayed. It's still funny in parts, but the sidekick / like driver, the they overplay that too much. There are moments where that callback is funny and then they overdo that. And yes. It's just like,
Yeah, it's one of those things where they are like, when it hits big, it hits. When it misses, it misses for me. And I'm very, very wishy-washy on this as on a second watching of just kind of going through, trying to
think. Yeah. Cause I mean, part of it is, I think that
going and finding the going to the room of the guy that they think is Arthur Brisbane at the time. And he thinks he's a Cocker Spaniel. That joke went on a little too long. Like,
yeah, and some of these spoof movies tend to kind of literally lose the plot, and it's unfortunate because I think what these movies sing the most is when you have this tight story, and this one, the story is just like kind of flying by the seat of its pants and just kind of going with what Hitchcock movie what we want to play in right now. And there is one, I'll say there is one joke that I thought I was going to freaking hate because it was such an obvious thing to do. And I was expecting it, but I kind of didn't want it. And then by the end of the joke, because when the joke started, I was like, yeah, I didn't like this. But by the end of the joke, I was laughing. And that is the Psycho parody.
Okay. The Psycho parody nailed it for me.
It absolutely does.
In one moment, because I didn't like
it. Is it the ink going down the drain?
Yes. Yes, it's the ink going down the drain.
That is why the joke works. Absolutely.
So to set this up and to spoil the joke, Thorndike goes to a conference in San Francisco where they go to the Hyatt Regency San Francisco. And since we're starting to talk about that, I'll cover that in a second.
I love the way that hotel looks so much.
I'm going to pause you right here, Miles. I'm going to pause you right here because we're going to have a very long discussion about this hotel. So, but
built in 1923.
No, it was it was 1973 actually.
That was
so. Anyway, he keeps asking this bellboy for a newspaper, and the bellboy's like, yeah, I'll get it. Yeah, I'll get it. Yeah, I'll get it. And that joke doesn't land for me. It's all kind of lame, and I don't like it. Until the bellboy enters his hotel room while he's taking a shower with a rolled-up newspaper and does the psycho bit. And it's like, okay, all right, Mel, you're selling this a little much. And then it zooms out, and the newspaper has the ink that is running down the drain in the way that the blood ran down the drain in Psycho. And that moment in particular nails everything for me.
Yep. So, fully agreed. Because when that joke started, I was like, ugh. And then by the end of it, I was like, okay, that was pretty good.
So let's talk about the Hyatt Regency Hotel in San Francisco. It opened in 1973, and keep in mind, this movie came out in 1976. So at the time, this hotel was pretty brand spanking new, and it was it's at the Embarcadero. It's still open, and it was the quote unquote temple of hermetic urbanism in a self-contained sci-fi style. That while today is dated, but visually dazzling in a retro futuristic sort of way.
Yes, basically all the architecture that Drew and I deeply love is like this.
Yeah. Well, Miles, do you know who designed the Hyatt Regency San Francisco?
Nope.
The Hyatt Regency San Francisco was designed by a man from Walhalla, South Carolina, named John Portman Jr. John Portman Jr. Grew up and started his career after graduating from Georgia Tech by basically designing all of downtown Atlanta.
That makes sense.
The America's Mart section. It was called Merchandise Mart then. Now it's called America's Mart. He's designed a number of things, but what his first Atrium Hotel, the hotel that I literally go to every year, the Hyatt Regency Atlanta, is in much the very same style of this hotel in High Anxiety. The Hyatt Regency opened in 67. So it was sort of a prototype version, to the point where the elevators that you see in the San Francisco hotel in this movie are the same exact style of elevators that are in the Hyatt Regency in Atlanta, with sort of like the domed lighted tops and bottoms. All of the, I'm going to send you a picture. So when I say that I absolutely love this hotel,
yes,
Miles, this is a Dragon Con hotel. Dragon Con is in this hotel. I know, you know, and I've been trying to get you to go to Dragon Con for 20 something years now. But seeing Mel Brooks run around this hotel is like seeing Mel Brooks run around Dragon Con, because the designs of the hotels are so, so similar, including all of the little inset like plant boxes on the edges, the balconies and things like that. It's such a cool hotel. And it was designed and built by an Atlanta icon, John Portman. And I just had to make sure that got stated, because it's a big deal. If you're on the East Coast and you want a taste of what the Hyatt Regency San Francisco is like and was like, the Hyatt in Atlanta. Hyatt Regency Atlanta. So,
okay. I'm down.
Yeah, he also designed the Marriott Marquis in New York City. He designed the Westin Bonaventure in L.A. Like, he's a big deal. Passed away in 2017. He's a big, big deal in architecture, and of course, his work is helping. His work is already immortalized, but it's additionally immortalized by this film. Anyway, Let's talk about the birds joke, because that's fun. Mel Brooks gets pooped on a lot.
This is one of those jokes where I was like, it absolutely feels right in a Mel Brooks movie. For whatever reason, this one just didn't quite land for me. I do like the very, so Mel Brooks is sitting on a park. He's on the run at this point for a murder that he didn't commit, but he's sitting on a park bench and he starts to notice that these birds keep popping up on the tree behind him and then kind of all around him. And then the droppings start. And so he gets a little nervous and he's gonna start skedaddling. Now we the viewer know this is a taking the piss of Hitchcock's The Birds, in which the birds try to kill people. In this one, they are focused purely on duking on Mel.
Miles, I am so sorry to derail this conversation. Did you see the Big Bird Bombs Over Baghdad Birds parody video from like a week and a half ago?
Yes.
That was very, very good. I just have to say, that's very, yeah, very good.
This is kind of one of those things where that the gag just doesn't sing for me. I think this is the kind of stuff that does lose me a little bit. It's not that it's awful. I just feel like it's kind of, meh.
Yeah. And again, it's one of those things where when it works, it really works. Like the Psycho bit. When it is okay, it's okay. Like the Birds bit. There are other things that don't work nearly as well.
I feel like once Madeline Kahn enters, you have this like really good period of like, oh, we are firing on all cylinders.
You talked about it at the beginning, the airport.
But it's not just that, like from her introduction,
Madeline Kahn. Madeline Kahn was an absolute master champion. Mm-hmm. Because she looks dazzling. She looks like this sort of, you know, starlet of the era, but she's willing to get in there and just do the bits. The two of them pretending to be the old couple in the airport.
It's the best part of the movie.
It is the best part of the movie. It is absolutely the funniest scene in the movie.
When they're asking him to put his bags in the x-ray, and he starts throwing the vegetables out. He's like, what? You want to bomb in here? It's so good. That whole sequence, even him getting the gun through the metal detector is so good. It's so funny.
And
it's not that Mel Brooks is good. We know he's good. But seeing Madeline Kahn just completely own the scene. And frankly, with all of these, at this point, time-tested comedic or troupe actors, to have Madeline Kahn, this was maybe her second or third movie, I think.
Oh, I mean, I don't know if it was her second or third movie. It's her third Mel Brooks movie, because she was in both Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, okay. I think this might have been her fourth picture. But like the fact that like Drew said, someone who like a layman would just not expect to be on this level. Although the starlets of the 40s and 50s and 60s were all like kind of Renaissance women. They knew how to be screwball. They knew how to do horror, action, romance. Like they kind of had to stay alive in the studio system. But to see her go toe to toe comedically with one of the 20th century masters, hold her own completely. You like after that scene, I'm just like, I just have all the respect in the world for this person, because she just rules.
I love Madeline Kahn so much, and we were robbed of 40 more years of Madeline Kahn stuff.
Agreed. Was it throat cancer?
I don't remember what cancer it was, but
because it was like, what, 98 that she passed?
It was 99. She was
99?
Only,
okay, yeah.
And she was young. She was only 57. Like,
jeez.
Explicit tag, fuck cancer. There we go.
Yeah, 100%. And you know better than me, because you probably have seen all of this stuff. Did Mel work with, I know he has a 6 degree of separation with, but did he ever work with Betty White?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Because I know Betty was very close with Carl Reiner.
I don't know that they did.
Because Carl always loves saying, the biggest regret of his life is that he didn't beat Betty's wife to the punch.
They apparently both had roles in Toy Story 4.
Well, that doesn't count.
That doesn't count.
I meant, was she ever like, I would have thought she maybe was on TV with when Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner had their show, because Betty started off, you know, really in TV and live TV. And I just figured they probably did something in the same circles, because I know that she and Carl worked together quite a bit throughout the years.
Yeah, supposedly, at least according to Google AI, the only thing they ever worked together on was Toy Story 4 and the follow-up series Forky Asks a Question, but they did not work together prior to that.
That's kind of shocking to me, honestly. Although, I mean, during this time, Betty was not necessarily not working. She was a big network comedian star, so, you know, it makes sense, but I don't know. I mean, especially with Cloris, I would have loved to seen a movie with like those three together.
Look, Miles, we could talk about the things we were robbed.
I know. I'm just like these elder comedians, especially Cloris Leachman and Betty White, are like some of my all time favorites. I love them so much. And I love discovering stuff of theirs that I haven't seen. Because some of the stuff is just hard to find. Like, yes, there's a lot of good documentaries, especially since both women passed, on them, and that focuses on their work and stuff has been brought up. And I'm sure, knock on wood, on hopefully a day nowhere near today, when Mel Brooks goes, I'm sure we will see stuff that we have never seen before. But yeah, I was just curious about that. Because yeah, Madeline Kahn, Cloris Leachman, like the women in his movies, he casts, or the casting director casts so well, which I think Anne Bancroft was involved with for a bit.
I don't,
wasn't Anne she?
Anne Bancroft influenced a lot of his casting choices.
I know
for
she had some say in stuff, because I know she's given a lot of credit for the success of some of his films.
But the fact that, like, and this is, again, you know, read into this what you will, but the fact that his female cast members across most of his films are so funny and allowed to do the huge, big laugh-getting bits.
And they return to work with him again.
Often multiple times. Like,
it says a lot.
It says so much. Because, again, you know, there are plenty of people of this era that would only have a hot lady be a hot lady and not have anything to do. There are plenty of people that would have cast Madeline Kahn to be a glamorous, beautiful woman in a film and not let her pretend to be an old Jewish housewife at an airport. But Mel's going to let her do what
all
she
that
can
and
do.
More.
God, yeah, Madeline Kahn is so funny. God, she's so good.
And that's what makes this movie a tough one to kind of rate, because like we've both said, when this movie soars, it just sings. But the paper thin story mixed with a lot of like middling jokes in between great bits does kind of taper this down. I do feel like it's still a good watch. You're going to have a good time. This is a good movie, and I think it's a far smarter movie than it gets a lot of credit for, but it also, for me, suffers in enough areas to where, like, I see why this is not part of the Brooks classic canon, but it is certainly worth talking about. I think the problem with this movie, and I'm not going to say it's only sin, because it does, you know, like I said, the writing is a little... I don't say lazy, but it's just not always on target.
Yeah.
This also comes after like a pretty red hot streak.
I mean, even if you don't count Silent Movie, which I think Silent Movie is not quite as good as Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, but those two movies happening in the same year is incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that can't be ignored. And when an artist puts out even a single movie of the caliber of either Blazing Saddles or Young Frankenstein, they permanently put that expectation on them for the rest of their lives.
Yes.
And the thing is High Anxiety a funny movie? Yes. Is it a good comedy? Also, yes. Is it a Mel Brooks classic with a capital C? No.
Lowercase.
It's a very smart movie.
Lowercase C.
It's a lowercase C. Absolutely. It's a good movie. But this is the problem when you have directors like a Spielberg, like a Rob Reiner, like a Catherine Bigelow, like that have directed movies that are in the American canon that are like defiable, you know, movies that are generational classics. They're on your AFI list. It doesn't matter if it's Schindler's List or E.T. or Jaws, or if it's Spinal Tap, Princess Bride, or When Harry Met Sally.
I thought you were going to talk about some of Spielberg's lesser known works like Ready Player One. Remember when Spielberg directed Ready Player One?
Unfortunately, he directed the film based on the book I don't like. Yes, I do remember that. And I mean, it's I guess a passable popcorn film, if that's what you want.
I liked the book, but that's a different.
I know you did.
I know. We did it on the show 20 years ago.
I'm just talking about like these people will never, no matter how many movies they end up directing, and obviously Rob Reiner's career is unfortunately finished, but once you even do Jaws, and the fact that like Spielberg has so many more, you could be like, well, but this one, you're still the guy who made Jaws for the rest of your life. And Mel Brooks will always be the guy who made Blazing Saddles, the guy who made Young Frankenstein, the guy who made Robin Hood Men in Tights. No matter how many good movies he made otherwise, because those are the films that have been accepted into the classic canon.
It's so funny you keep mentioning Men in Tights. Men in Tights was not that loved. Spaceballs was way more loved than Men in Tights.
Ask people now.
No, here, Miles.
Men in Tights is as loved as any of his films now.
Yes, because people like us
watch them repeatedly on video.
Are now old.
Well, look, the old guard finally got their claws out of things, and all the things that we loved and tried to convince people to love are now being loved. There's a reason a Goofy movie has seen such a resurgence in the last 10 years.
Robin Hood Men in Tights is a movie that I deeply love. It was the first Mel Brooks movie I'd ever seen. Because it was...
I think it was mine, too.
It was the... I mean, because I didn't know who Mel Brooks was.
May have seen Spaceballs.
I don't know that I had. I don't know that I had.
Because I thought I knew it was Mel Brooks or a Star Wars thing. I would have probably just watched the sci-fi comedy and then... Oh, it's Star Wars.
Yeah. But we also... But Men in Tights was also a situation where, like, that was the blockbuster era. I rented that movie and I watched it four times over the 3 days that we had it. It was so funny. And I've seen that movie so often. I have cosplayed that movie in the Hyatt Regency Hotel in Atlanta made by John Portman, who made the hotel in San Francisco in High Anxiety. That's a pretty wild moment. Anyway,
I met Cary Elwes last week.
For real?
Yeah.
I don't think I knew that.
Did I not?
I don't think you
did. I thought I texted a picture of me and Krista at the theater. He hosted a Q&A and meet and greet and screening of Princess Bride and told a lot of really great Andre the Giant stories and why he thinks he almost got fired the first week because he took Andre's... four-wheeler joyriding and broke his toe. But
that'd do it.
Met Cary Elwes last week.
Cary Elwes also featured heavily, of course, in that Mel Brooks documentary we talked about, The 100-Year-Old Man, we talked about last week, or 99-Year-Old Man.
Good, because I everyone was asking questions, obviously, about Rob Reiner and Andre the Giant, and it was a Princess Bride event. Anytime someone tried to talk about something else, the moderator kind of corralled the conversation Princess Bride. I get, and Princess Bride's a phenomenal movie, 5 out of 5.
I have zero negative things to say about Princess Bride.
No, love that movie. Was not upset to watch it again on a big screen with the star. Also got a signed copy of his book as a result.
Nice.
But I feel like this movie is a very, very solid film. It's a very smart film when it's smart, which sounds like a cop out, but like, it's just a very inconsistently executed film.
Yes, that's
but filled with great ideas, great performers, and some really incredible gags. Like, this is not a bad time. And look, a just fine Mel Brooks movie is still better than 90% of the comedies that come out per year.
100%. So, Miles, I feel like we can close the book on High Anxiety.
Yeah, I wish there was more to really like chew on and discuss with this one, but like you said, it's a lot of visual gags.
And it's a lot of gags that if we talk about it, it's not as interesting. It's not as funny.
Yeah, I do love the anecdote that you know, he did get Hitchcock's, like, he did work with him a little bit to kind of get his into his head, and then Hitchcock sent him a thing of like 6 bottles of fancy wine,
because Mel was worried that Hitchcock wasn't gonna like it, and then Hitchcock saw it in a preview screening, didn't say anything as he left, and then sent Mel a case of 6 magnums of 1961 Chateau Haut-Brionne with a note that read, "A small token of my pleasure. Have no anxiety about this."
It's just one of those bits that I love to pieces. That's one of those Hollywood stories. I'm like, oh, yes, love that. Nice little bow. Mwah.
Yeah.
Wish the movie lived up to that anecdote. But again, any slight I have against this movie, this is still a very, very funny movie. I really enjoyed it quite a bit. We didn't talk about a lot of the bit characters, but I mean, they fulfill their roles. I think that
we have a James Bond reference in the braces,
which I thought was kind of lazy.
Yeah, I did too.
I generally, when anyone does a James Bond pastiche, I think making a Jaws reference is always the laziest thing to do.
Honestly, I would have loved for Mel to have made a James Bond parody at some point, but
fully agreed.
That well might have been a little dry. I also forget that Mel wrote on Get Smart for the entirety of its run, so maybe he'd already done that.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would have liked to because he does do a good like wash on certain types of movies. I would have liked him have seen him go after like a 40s studio picture like Casablanca, those late noir films. I think that would have been very, very fun.
We still got time, Miles. We still got time.
He ain't even directing Spaceballs, too. I think he's done directing anything.
He's 100 years old. I love Mel Brooks.
I do, too.
I'm going to be devastated.
Hey, let him write.
I'm going to be devastated when he goes, even though he's 100 freaking years old. That's the thing. But, yeah. We love you, Mel. You'll never hear this, but it's okay. Maybe somebody will tell you how much two dudes in the southeastern United States love talking about your stuff.
Yeah. I wish there was more to say about this one, but I do recommend checking it out. It's not the easiest movie to find, but it's not like insanely difficult.
So with that said, let's close the book on High Anxiety. And I had a hard time, Miles, coming up with what we're going to do next week.
Oh boy.
Because I literally just talked about one of my ideas for next week that I decided against because I thought maybe it was flying a little too close to the sun.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to help me have me discuss walking you through the rest of your immortal stuff in Destiny.
No, I don't need that. No, what? Well, what?
I don't think the show needs like a 10th episode on freaking Destiny.
Doesn't need a 10th episode on Destiny. And it definitely doesn't need a 4th episode on Robin Hood Men in Tights. But by the time anybody hears this that isn't on this call right now, I will be 42 years old.
Are you going to do what I think you're going to do?
And you might be thinking, well, you know, Drew, there's a great book that you could read about that number. And no, we've already done that. Go back and listen to it. Well, there's a fun movie that we could talk about that covers that number. It's like, no, I'm pretty sure we've done that too. When it was brand new in theaters. Maybe we haven't. I don't know. I don't like that movie quite as much. But you know, there's...
I like parts of it. I almost equate to High Anxiety. There's things that I think are brilliant about that movie, and there's stuff that, yeah, it's fine.
I just don't like Martin Freeman.
I don't think I knew that.
But there's one thing. There's one piece of this oeuvre. Well, there's a couple of pieces of this oeuvre that I've never seen. And it's one that I've always been kind of curious about. So we are going to go all the way back to 1981 and watch the 6 episodes of the BBC television adaptation of Douglas Adams' The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which aired between January and February 1981 in the United Kingdom, and then kind of went around loosely based on the radio series that predated the book and all of that stuff. It's only 6 episodes, which also both surprises me and doesn't surprise me at all. But yeah, I have never seen this series. I know that people love it. Of course, I've read all of the books, and I plan to go through at least the first one, if not hopefully the whole run of books of the 5-book trilogy this year, now that I am the number of life, the universe, and everything. But I would really love to see this show. So The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy 1981 series. It is available, weirdly, on a lot of the streaming services that are tied to libraries. I don't think it's on any of the main streaming services right now. It's very cheap on Amazon. It's very cheap on iTunes Store. And there might be an archive organization that also has access to it that you can check it out. So we're going to take a little break from Mel next week and talk about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
All right. I am down. I have never seen this before.
I haven't either. It's going to be great. I know the book very well.
I am very, very familiar with the cover art of this thing. I don't know why. I think it used to pop up in like maybe magazines, or I used to pass it by like a VHS in Blockbuster or something. I truly do not know.
All I know is screenshots that have Zaphod's extremely bad paper mache second head. I'm excited. Oh, I'm excited to see this, because again, this is like Doctor Who style Hitchhiker's Guide, which is funny because Douglas Adams wrote on Doctor Who as well. So yeah, that's gonna be next week. Boy howdy, gonna be a fun one. So with that said, gang, this is where we're gonna wrap up the episode. If you would like to find us, you can find us at just about everywhere, but start at themoreyounerd.com, where you can find this and every other episode of our show. You can find us on social media, either at themoreyounerd or /themoreyounerd, just about everywhere. And you can email us, themoreyounerd@gmail.com. That's themoreyounerd@gmail.com. In addition, you can find us at CosmicCrit.com. What's Cosmic Crit, you ask? Well, that's the show where Miles and I and all of our friends play tabletop role-playing games, specifically the game Starfinder by Paizo. It's like D&D in space, and it's really cool. And we are about to kick off all of our content for CritterCon 2026, which is happening in just a month and a half or something crazy like that. So that's going to be awesome. Go to CosmicCrit.com to find out all that information. And also join the Cosmic Crit Discord, where you can find your own tabletop role-playing games to play, or just talk to me and Miles all day while we are bored at work. So with that said, gang, we're going to end the show as we always do with a rousing
nerd
out.
Two nerd for y'all.